Nacho Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Thank you to all of you joining us for the 57th episode of the Calcio Land podcast. So on today's show, we have our friend Nima Tavalli, who's going to give us some insight on the Swedish national team, who's playing Italy on Friday in the first leg of the playoffs. I have to tell you that after that interview with Nima, I am very worried about the Italian national team. And then we're going to close with a first-time guest, Matt Lichtenstatter, who's been covering MLS for the Marzio site for quite some time. We wanted to have him on to talk a little bit about Pirlo's last game, Giovinco Toronto FC. So even if you don't know much or don't care much about MLS, I think you'll find that interview interesting, and that's at the end of the podcast. But before we get to all that, as well as winners and losers and your questions, we are joined by our great co-host, producer, Alex Goldberg. I have a feeling, Alex, this was a little bit of a roller coaster of a ride for you this weekend. The speculation on Conte and Milan, then the big win that Chelsea had about Manchester United. This morning we read about Imanalo's departure. So I wanted to get your take on everything that's going on at Chelsea right now.
Oh, man. You know, sometimes I wish Chelsea just treated their managers like Arsenal treat Arsene Wenger, because there'd be a lot less headlines about the manager. David, it is ridiculous how cutthroat Chelsea seem to be with managers. They win a championship with Mourinho, he's sacked the next year. They win the title last year with Conte, and immediately we start talking about him going back to Italy, way before these rumors about AC Milan this last week. But David, I said it in the preview episode when we talked about maybe Conte eventually wanting to coach Inter to get back at Juventus. I said, I love Antonio Conte as a hire. He's been great with Chelsea, but I want him at Chelsea for the long haul. I want him to build a foundation, sort of like he did at Juventus. But clearly, when anything goes wrong at Chelsea, immediately the going back to Italy rumors start with him. So I don't know. It was a whirlwind, as you said, a roller coaster. It was a fantastic win against Manchester United. It's just funny before the game how everyone's like, well, Conte's trying to get sacked and he wants to lose against Man U so he can get sacked. And then they win. It was a fantastic win. Morata scores a great goal. And now Conte's happy at Chelsea, and now he's staying. But all of a sudden, as you just said, the technical director, Michael Emanalo, is out, which excites a lot of Chelsea fans. But no one really knows. Yeah. No one really knows who makes the deals anyway. So, David, my conclusion after this whole weekend, after all the rumors, is Alvaro Morata is going to be the key to Antonio Conte staying at Chelsea, just because there's a lot of debate on who's Conte's guys, who aren't Conte's guys. You know, which people did he want at the club, which did he not? Clearly, he wanted Morata, and Morata has been fantastic, and it's very important to have a great number nine. And let's pretend AC Milan is the team Conte could go to. Well, Andre Silva is not Alvaro Morata. Nobody on AC Milan actually at this point is Alvaro Morata. Of course, Eden Hazard's the best player, and there's no Hazard on Milan. But I think Morata will be the main key in Conte staying for a long period of time. That was his guy. He's playing well. That's the guy that needs to keep Antonio Conte at Chelsea. So all of it is on you, Morata. So that's my take on all the scuttlebutt and the malarkey that's been going on with Antonio Conte. But David, I got to ask, what do you think the chances are that we do see Antonio Conte at AC Milan?
So I have a lot of thoughts on this. And one of the rules that I've had for our podcast in general is, you know, when it comes to Milan and all the situation with the club, I really try not to speculate. There's a lot that can be said about the finances, how the club was bought, the Elliott Fund. So I'm going to try to really stick to facts and not go much with speculation. So this is my take. If Conte really, really wants to come back to Italy at a top club, I don't realistically see any other place where he could go. For a while, I thought there was a chance that he could go back to Juve the way Lippi and Trapattoni did in the past. After the recent back and forth he had with Juve's president, Andrea Agnelli, I'm going to write that off at least for the foreseeable future. You mentioned Inter and Conte, who when we started our podcast looked like something that could make a lot of sense. But Spalletti has been sensational there unless he has a huge collapse. I don't see that. We've seen Di Francesco at Roma really do great work. Sarri at Napoli, you know, even if he were to leave, I'm just not sure Conte is a good fit with Napoli's president, De Laurentiis. So we know that Italy is always very attractive to Conte. I don't see anywhere else realistically where he could go. Flip side to that is we do know that a Conte now is probably at a different point of his career than he was when he agreed to join Juve. You can make a lot of parallels with Milan right now. They're constant rebuilding back and forth to get back on track. But Conte has a little bit more cachet and pedigree. You know, he got Chelsea to give him a big raise. You know, if they decide not to fire him, he'd have to force his way out. I'm sure he's got a lot of clubs that would love to have him. You know, PSG is just one that comes to mind. So with Milan, and I'm not going to speculate on the club's finances, I'm just literally going to use the quotes from their executive director, Fassone, who has said that if the club doesn't make the Champions League, they would have to sell 1 to 2 key players, which tells me, by flip side, is they probably can't make a lot of other additions, that those 1 or 2 players that have to leave would be more to balance the books. So Conte would have to give up, you know, having a huge transfer budget, and if Milan doesn't qualify for the Champions League, that opportunity. The same side, Milan has quite a few players that I think would suit his style as is, and you can say that Montella hasn't gotten the most out of the talent. Of course, Bonucci's there. They have the two good wing backs to play the 3-4-3, whatever you want to use, with Conte and Rodriguez, some midfielders that maybe Conte would get a lot out of. So I'm not going to exclude it. It didn't surprise me that Milan, with all the disappointment going on there, I'm sure they were more than happy that this reliable news is out there that they were pursuing Conte. I just don't think that it's an absolute slam dunk with the Champions League and the finances. But again, we know that Conte is great at rebuilding projects, and if the idea of going back to Italy is so important to him, that's probably the most logical place. So that's my take. I'm sure we're going to get back at this subject more and more in the future, but that far, this is my 2 cents on it.
Yeah, I feel like there's going to be 1,000 more headlines. He's going, he's staying. I mean, hell, he just got Zappacosta, Chelsea's first Italian player, for a while. So you got to stay, Antonio. We got an Italian on board. All right, well, let's do our segment. We do it every episode. We love it. David, now that the weekend is gone, I think we're done with 12 rounds of Serie A now. Who are winners and losers of episode 57 of the Calcioland podcast?
So I'm kind of going to go in the order of the games. So on Saturday, we had Crotone, big win against Bologna, big win in the race to avoid relegation. Last week, we talked about how tight it is. And Crotone had 2 goals by the striker Budimir, who I think they've had before they sold to Sampdoria. Struggled there in his back. He had a brace there. Another player that had a brace in that match, Bologna lost, is trequartista Verdi, sensational player who off free kicks scored 1 with his left foot and another 1 with his right foot. I've never seen that in a game. I'm not sure if that's a first in Serie A, although Bologna lost, let's give a shout out to Verdi. Then in the derby between Genoa and Sampdoria, I called it Quagliarella was going to score. That was the one I got right. Over the weekend, that was his first goal in the Derby della Lanterna, so good for him. On Saturday, the early game, we had a Torino and Inter. Big point for Torino. I thought the goalkeeper, Sirigu, was sensational in that match. I tweeted it. To me, he's been a massive upgrade over Joe Hart. I saw a lot of Premier League fans had a lot of fun with that tweet. It really wasn't a dig much at Joe Hart, but more to give a shout-out to Sirigu. Another player that did very well in that match was Thomas Rincon, the midfielder who left Juve, did quite well for Torino. Another player that has been rejuvenated at Torino is Argentinian fullback Ansaldi, who's now made the Argentinian national team again, was dreadful at Inter, but is getting his mojo back with Torino. Eder had a goal off the bench for Inter tying the game, and I think his impact off the bench is why Ventura keeps selecting him to the Italian national team. Then on Juve, once again, Higuain and Cuadrado coming through, just like they did against Sporting Lisbon. So I have Higuain as a winner, Cuadrado again as a winner. Look, I get he's frustrating, but how many times do Juve fans complain all day long about him on Twitter, and then he comes up huge? So Cuadrado had an assist that's almost certainly going to get him out of the Champions League group. He gave him the goal to beat Benevento, and that would have been a tragedy for Juve if they didn't win that match. Then Roma, huge match for Gerson, talented Brazilian player that really didn't do much under Spalletti. Di Francesco gave him some confidence, had a brace against Fiorentina. Shout out to our main thousand who called that Roma would win in Florence. I had it as a draw. And then for Milan, I have two winners. Suso, once again, saving Montella. Great player. Has been really, really good for Milan. And I think there are some positive signs from Leo Bonucci. We said it on the podcast. That suspension, in a way, may have been a blessing in disguise. He needed a break. Some encouraging signs, both in the match against AEK Athens and against Sassuolo. Losers, we saw Juric, the Genoa coach, been on the hot seat. He was sacked, replaced by Ballardini, who did well at the club before. I have as a loser, and I forgot not to mention him last weekend, and that's Dybala. Has been really struggling recently. Hasn't scored in the Champions League since the quarterfinal against Barcelona. And Serie A took a little bit of a dip recently. He's also having some issues with Allegri, so that's something to look at. Sassuolo lost to Milan, off really to a dreadful start. I think their coach Bucchi could be one of the next to be sacked. Kalinic at Milan, we'll get into the questions. I have him as a loser, and I hate to put him as a loser, but I'm going to mention Sarri's lack of rotation, and we got a good question on this. I'm going to put him as a loser there. I had no doubt going into the game that Napoli wasn't going to win against Chievo, and that's got to be on him a little bit. So as much as it pains me to say it, I'm going to have him as the loser. Now, who's definitely not a loser is the people who send in the great questions via Twitter. You can do it with the CalcioLand hashtag. We have another episode on Thursday, so keep them coming. Which ones do we have today, Alex?
All right, well, let's start with that loser. David, is it fair to criticize Sarri's rotation when Napoli has half of Juve's payroll?
I think it's fair. And I think, look, you can definitely point to the payroll on Juve. Juve has great depth. But Napoli, you know, everyone keeps saying they have bad depth. And up front, you know, maybe not his fault that Milik got hurt again and they have nobody there. Sarri's always said he doesn't get involved with transfer moves. He just manages the players that they give him. But Napoli, to me, has given him quite a few players that should be good bench players. And when I ask myself, you know, who could be a good bench player on a team like Napoli that's in the Champions League, you would think someone that's considered an above-average starter in Serie A on another team would be a good bench player for a team like Napoli. And in recent years, they've invested a lot in players like Maximovic and Tonelli, two center backs. Those guys, he doesn't trust them at all. He trusts Chidić more. The midfield, you know, he has Zielinski, Diarra, Raj. I mean, that could be a starting midfield on a lot of teams in Serie A. He has Giaccherini, who was a valuable player for Conte at the last Euro. He has this young player, Unas, from Bordeaux. So, look, you know, to me, it seems like Napoli has tried to bring in bench players, and I love Sarri. I've always said tactically, to me, he's clearly the best manager in Serie A, but there's more to it. And I think, too, yeah, it's hard to get into Sarri's system, but you also got to give him confidence and let him play. Like, I can think of a lot of matches earlier in the season that Napoli blew away teams like Benevento, and he was still starting his A team. Like, I think he just needs to do a better job with this. You know, sometimes giving a player confidence, giving them a start when maybe you're not 100% sure they deserve it might pay off in the long run. So I hate to say it. I think it is fair to blame him a little bit for his lack of a rotation.
All right. Well, a follow-up. How can you talk about whether Sarri stays or goes at Napoli as if it were his own decision? It's President De Laurentiis that chooses Sarri's future, right?
So, yeah, I think I've gone a little bit overboard with my love on Sarri, but look, I can take it. I think this is a fair question. So the reason I say that it's also up to Sarri. If he has this exit clause in his contract for 8 million euro, he can go to another team. So, you know, it's not cheap for a coach, but it's also not crazy amount for a team like, say, you know, Arsenal, Chelsea, or Paris Saint-Germain. That's nothing. So in that sense, I think he has some control. And like the person that tweeted this, they are right. Napoli has a lot of say, especially because Sarri has a series of one-year contracts with options that Napoli decides to bring him back or not. He didn't have much leverage when they hired him. So there's definitely some truth to that. I just don't know, as long as Sarri keeps playing and get results, if De Laurentiis could realistically think he could get someone better. But hey, he was able to hire Benitez. Not a lot of people expected that. So I think that's a fair question, but the reason why I say Sarri has some say is that exit clause.
All right, David, what do you make of Napoli's English language Twitter account?
So I know it gets mocked a lot, and over the weekend, I don't know if you saw it, Alex, there was one comment about, you know, something that in the porn industry is used. It was a little bit unfortunate. Now, granted, some people have pointed out that specific line, like, is grammatically correct and used in football. But just because something's grammatically correct doesn't necessarily mean that it's a good idea to tweet it. Since this is a family-style podcast, I'm not going to read that quote. So I'm going to give credit for Napoli in general for having an English Twitter account. Not every team in Serie A has a dedicated English Twitter account. I think, though, they can tweak it a little bit better. You know, if they want to be by the book and all, like, maybe try to make sure the things you tweet aren't going to be used inappropriately or whatnot. But overall, I got to give them credit for having it in the first place.
I'm sure the Bayern Twitter account is applauding somewhere. That's a pretty damn good one. All right, David, both of the Roman clubs are doing great. On current form, where in the table will they finish?
So, yeah, both clubs are doing great, and both Roma and Lazio have one less game played because Roma had that game against Sampdoria, Lazio the home one against Udinese. Fascinating race. So, you know, we've said it a lot on the podcast. So Roma's really surprised us. I think John Solano said it best. So Roma's off to a great start to the season. It just so happens that many other teams are even off to a better start. So I don't know if Roma can get back in the title mix, but they'll definitely be competing for a Champions League spot. Same with Lazio. But, of course, you know, there's also Inter, Juve, and Napoli. So one of these five teams will make it, and then we'll have to see if Milan can get back in the race. That's a lot of teams to make up. So exciting. I'm going to give Roma a slight edge over Lazio just because, you know, with Nainggolan, Dzeko, I think they have more of a safety net with veterans, but a very good development for both clubs. I think it's going to be a great race for those four Champions League spots.
Okay, David, is Montella's sacking inevitable? And if so, why wait when you could have a new manager working on the team during the international break?
So I think, you know, had Milan lost against the Sassuolo or drew, there was a decent chance they would have brought in Gattuso from the Primavera. And look, you know, on one hand, I totally get, look, you know, if we know it's just a matter of time that Montella's gone, why not just do it now? There's an international break. I'm just not sure if you want to burn out Gattuso the way they did with Pippo Inzaghi. I always go back to, you know, it's very easy to sack a manager. It's much harder to replace him with someone better. Look, if Milan knew that Conte was going to get sacked at Chelsea and he was available right away and he'd be willing to come in season, that's a no-brainer. If they knew that Ancelotti would agree to come in mid-season, then that's a no-brainer. But if not, you know, Paulo Sousa was a candidate. I don't know if he was an upgrade over Montella. He's going to China. So on one hand, I can kind of see what Milan is doing, maybe wait and see if situation changes and other candidates become available. At this point, it wouldn't shock me if Montella sticks around for a little bit. The first game back is against Napoli at the San Paolo. I'm not sure if they expect the result for him to keep his job. So an interesting situation, but again, easy to sack the manager, harder to find a better replacement.
All right, will Montella ever give Andre Silva a chance? What is with his obsession with Kalinic?
So So Andre Silva today turned 22. Happy birthday to him. Yeah, it's surprising because in the Europa League, he's done very well. It doesn't seem like Montella trusts him in Serie A. And look, we know there's big tactical adjustments in Serie A. And Kalinic, I mean, granted, Montella didn't coach him at Fiorentina, but everyone, including me, said how good he is for the system. And in a way, you could say that Kalinic has put himself in a lot of scoring opportunities for Milan in the past few weeks. He's just not converting them. So maybe in the system he's working and he's not converting the chances. And look, you know, I defended the Kalinic signing, but at this point, even more than Andre Silva, it's like, why aren't we seeing more of Cutrone? Like, every time that guy comes in, he makes an impact. So I think Montella was really sticking to the striker that fits the system, but it seems like his system's not working anyway, so maybe time for a change, and I'd love to see what Andre Silva can do.
All right, the last Twitter question. Do you think Donadoni is the right man to coach Bologna?
So I have to say I haven't seen a huge amount of Bologna matches this season. It seems they have had an up-and-down season, had some very good performances against Napoli and Inter, and ended up having no points, and they could have done well. Then they lose at home against Crotone. So, yeah, Donadoni has been really up and down. I've never been a huge fan of his as a manager. I always felt if he went back to Milan, I'm not sure that would have been a good move. So, you know, I'm not going to say it as a slight to Bologna, but maybe that's the type of club where he should be at. If Bologna wants to be a little bit more ambitious rather than just avoiding relegation comfortably, then maybe they can do something better there. So we're going to end the questions there. We got a lot of great ones on Italy as well, but today we're focusing more on Sweden with our interview with Nima, and on Thursday we'll talk about Italy. I'm going to bring in a guest for that, so I'm going to save those Italy questions then. So thanks again to all who sent in questions. Thanks to all who leave us reviews and retweet our podcast. We really appreciate it. Okay, so with Italy getting ready to face Sweden in the playoffs to qualify for the World Cup, I really couldn't think of a better person than having our great friend Nima Tavalli, who we've had multiple times on Calcioland. Now, you guys know Nima, of course, from Sempre Inter. He's been doing great work on goal with our friend Carlo Garganese here and there. But recently, he's been writing some great op-ed pieces for Calciomercato's English page. I have a weekly column there. But Nima's really putting out some great work. This week alone, he wrote on Spalletti, on how he's not the new Jose Mourinho at Inter. Then he also wrote about Conte being a nemesis for Mourinho. So really great stuff, Nima. So I'm glad to see you doing so well, and I'm thrilled that you're joining us to give us some insight on the Swedish national team. So how are you, and welcome back to Calcioland.
Thank you, David. It's a great it's great to be back. I love your podcast. You know that. I always listen to it. I think it's one of the best out there. And so it's nice to be back, and I'm doing fine. It's just really busy, as you mentioned.
Awesome. Okay, so let's jump right in. So Italy got Sweden in the draw. So I guess for you it must be bittersweet because, yeah, for people that don't know, you live in Sweden, but of course your passion is for Italian football. So before we get into the individual players, and I'm sure everyone by now knows that Ibrahimovic isn't going to play in these matches, before we get to the specific players, tell me a little bit how you would describe the Swedish national team as a unit. What do you consider to be their strengths and maybe their weaknesses?
Well, I think this Swedish national team is a little bit of return back to basics of how it was before Zlatan Ibrahimovic. Sweden's always been known for being a very strong collective unit, for working as a unit, a very organized and disciplined team tactically in terms of defense, defensively, especially under Lars Lagerbäck, who famously took Iceland to the European Championships. And built up that Icelandic team that now also has qualified for the World Cup for the first time, being the smallest country, I think, to ever qualify for the World Cup. So that's kind of what's happened after Zlatan Ibrahimovic. It's kind of been a return to basics, but they've kind of taken on the lessons they learned from the Ibrahimovic era, in that it's a rigidly controlled team, but they do allow freedom of an expression for their more technically gifted players, such as Emil Forsberg. So I'd say that the strength of this team is this organization. It's the fact that it's a good mix of old and young players. It's got, Victor Lindelof, Nilsson, who might not have, set the sky alight Manchester United, but he's a good defender. You have a lot of Serie A experience from players like Albin Ekdal, who played for Juventus, Cagliari, Siena, and then you have the captain Andreas Granqvist, who spent many seasons at Genoa. So it's a very evenly balanced team. And Emil Forsberg, of course, who's tearing it up at for Rasenballsport Leipzig in the Bundesliga. So it's a good. I would say that their strength is their collective unit. That it's a very evenly balanced team. The weaknesses I would say would be that the team lacks the high quality players that they had under Ibrahimovic. They don't have the player that can create something out of nothing. They don't have that. Their midfield, if you ask me, is a little bit sluggish. There's not that much creativity in it. So I would say it's a very technically limited team. I would say that's the biggest weakness.
Okay, so thinking, and you mentioned a few of the players, great insight there. So thinking too of where the strengths and weaknesses are on the Azzurri, which players, if you were advising Ventura, which ones should he be paying particular attention to in the next few days as he gets ready for the match?
Above all, if you look at Emil Forsberg in Leipzig, when he took them to second or third place last season in Bundesliga, and also this season in the Champions League, his biggest strength is when he gets to counter attack and attack space with the ball at his feet. He never misses a goal scoring opportunity. That so Italy will have to basically be very, very careful to not suffer too many counter-attacks and lose the ball in the middle of the pitch, which would allow especially Forsberg to attack space, because he's lethal there. He will score goals there. He's done it in the Bundesliga, in the Champions League. That's what they need to watch out for. Be very wary of Sweden's counter-attacks.
Interesting. So one thing, and this is when people were asking me before the draw who I thought Italy, who would they be better off facing, who they should avoid. My take was really simple. If the Italy we saw before the match against Spain, where everything fell apart, if Italy plays as close to their potential as they should, I don't think it really mattered who they face. Now, am I being a little bit too optimistic when it comes to Sweden? Do you think if, say, Italy plays better than what we saw in the last few matches, do you think if Sweden has their best match, they have a chance to keep up with Italy, or it's just a matter of which Italy shows up?
I think that the biggest weakness Italy has is Giampiero Ventura. And I've said this on Twitter, and I've said it on many shows as well, that I think that Sweden will knock Italy out. Not because I think they're a better team, because I think that the confusion, it's a little bit of the perfect storm brewing in Italy, if you think about it. You have a Buffon that is going to retire at the end of this season. You have a Bonucci who's had a dreadful start at a Milan that's in crisis. You have a Barzagli that's a little bit over the hill. So basically, that famous BBC defensive line is not what it used to be. Then you have a coach who has created so much confusion by his 4-2-4 lineup, especially against Spain, but also against Macedonia and other teams. It has not looked good. Defensively, Ventura has never been a strong coach. So to me, Italy look really, really confused, and it's a little bit a perfect storm brewing. Sweden, on the other hand, are very, very tactically drilled. They're very disciplined. Every Swedish player knows what they need to do, and it's a very hungry team that wants to prove that they are a good side, even if Zlatan Ibrahimovic has retired. So for me, I think Italy did not want to play against Sweden. I think that was the worst draw they could have had. And when I interviewed Kenneth Anderson, the former Bologna and Lazio striker for Calciomercato, I think he said it best. He said when he saw the draw, he was really annoyed because he wanted both teams to go to the World Cup. But as he hit the nail on the head when he said that Sweden has never been closer to beating Italy over two matches than they are right now, simply because of the fact that It's an Italy team that maybe the most important players a little bit on their way down, while Sweden is on their way up. There's been some confusion. Defensively, Italy have always been strong, but now they're not. So, but having said that, you know, it's Italy. I mean, if you look at that squad, if you look at that midfield, I mean, I personally hope to see a 3-5-2 where the central midfield is De Rossi, Baratti, and Jorginho. And I think that's a good midfield. That's a midfield that can win you the World Cup, if you ask me. It's a fantastic central midfield. And if he can get those players to work in that system, and if he goes back to that 3-5-2, which Italy, where he'd get the best out of them, with Bonucci, Barzagli, and Chiellini, and Buffon in goal, and then he has a plethora of talent on the wings, with Florenzi, with Darmian, with Zappacosta, Spinazzola. I mean, Italy are looking finally, you know, they're looking good again. It's the dark days are over. I'm very optimistic for Italy. But it's Ventura, and Ventura, I don't know. I think that this is the perfect time for Sweden to play Italy. I really do.
Wow. So you sound pretty bold. So you think I should put some money on Sweden? Or I mean, I know a lot of you. Your heart is always with Italy too, kind of like me. But you sound pretty confident. So
I think
they have a pretty good chance.
I do. I if I were to put any money on this, I'd say that the first game in Sweden will end 0-0, and I think the second game in San Siro will be 1-1.
Wow.
And Sweden will go through on that. So it won't be a lot of goals scored. I think the more time passes, the more frustrated Italy will get. Sweden will be completely focused on not conceding in the first match. Absolutely. So I expect that Italy to have the ball 90% of the time and try to create something with the Sweden that is just waiting to pounce on the counterattack. It won't be parking the bus as much, but they will definitely try to diminish and decrease as much space as possible for Italy's central midfield, pushing them out to the wings, and then try to clog up and win any cross balls with Granqvist and Nilsson Lindelöf, who are very strong in the air. So I honestly think, and like you said, I support that, absolutely. I don't support Sweden. My passion is Italian football. I feel we have a surprise. We have a historic surprise going to happen in the next week.
Wow, very interesting. So, Neem, I can't have you on my podcast without at least asking you one question on Inter. So I kind of wanted to frame it in this term. So let's pretend Inter right now is a stock trading on the stock market. Off to a great start. You know, in the past, we've seen Mancini's team not that long ago get off to a really impressive start. So if you wanted to be pessimistic, you could say, well, we've seen this from Inter before. Now we have Spalletti instead of Mancini, big difference. Also, to me, if you want to be optimistic for Inter, you can say that three of the players they got this summer, Joao Cancelo, Dalbert, and Caramo, we haven't seen much of them. So there's margin for improvement just with these players. I have a feeling they'll be fairly active in January. So based on all these things, if you have Inter stock right now, would you look to keep it? Would you look to sell it? Would you be buying more? What would you do?
I would, if it depends on what my expectation is. If my expectation is to see the Inter stock finish top three or top four in the Serie A, I definitely buy more stocks. But I would hedge my bet, because I think that if Borja Valero or Matias Vecino get injured, then this Inter is very, very, that'll cause them a lot of trouble, because they're so important. I mean, Skriniar, yeah. Borja Valero, Vecino, these three have just gone straight into the starting lineup and raised the quality of the team. Now, Spalletti has been sensational. I don't think we can overestimate the work he's done. I think he's completely changed the mentality at Inter. He's created the professionalism around the team, the way he ties together the team. His man-man management is very modern. It works really well with these players. So I think we cannot overestimate the influence and the impact that he's had. But having said that, Borja Valero is 30, 31, 32, and if he gets injured, he's really, really important. And we saw also that when teams man-mark Borja Valero, Inter, they can lock Inter. But the game against Torino we saw on the weekend was more an issue of squandered chances. I never seen Icardi. I mean, I tweeted it out, but Icardi missed more chances in the first half against Torino than he has in his entire career at Inter. I've never seen that happen. So that's also something that needs to be taken into consideration. But I do not expect to see Inter crashing like under Mancini for several reasons. Mainly, this is a better team. The club is much more stable, better owners, better organization, better structure. We have a better coach. We have players like D'Ambrosio and Nagatomo, who I've been bitching about in all to you and everyone else, that they've raised their level. Spalletti is that kind of coach that takes players and gets them to raise their level from the level they're at. And that's something that they've done. You mentioned João Cancelo and Dalbert. It's pretty clear that Spalletti believes in these players. He just doesn't want to play them yet because he wants them to first understand Italian football and understand his football. So he's taking away all pressure on them. And Cancelo obviously has also been injured. And Caramo, who came on, was brilliant when he came on and changed the game for Inter. So I'm not too worried. I expect Inter to be active on the transfer window in January in terms of bringing in a trequartista, because that is a role where Inter has, has not managed to fill that at all. Borja Valera has not been good there. João Mario has not been good there. It hasn't worked. I think Pastore, the more they talk about Pastore, the more I actually believe that rumor, because Pastore is only 27 years old. He knows Sabatini. I think he would be perfect for Inter. So I would say a trequartista or someone like that, and also maybe a central defender, because with Van Huijsen injured, it's very clear that Spalletti does not trust or rate Andrea Ranocchia. He does not want to bring him in. And you gotta give him credit, and you gotta believe in his judgment, because so far, I can't think of a single mistake that Spalletti has done when he's been given the chance to decide something. I think he's handled himself exceptionally well, and he's actually outperformed my own expectations. I did not rate him. I didn't think he was able to do as good, or he was at this high level that he's been at. I knew he was good, but I didn't know he was this good. The team, this Inter, he's gotten them playing just a few months. He's played, they're perfect defensively, almost. The build-up in midfield is fantastic. And he's created a positive vibe where everyone's working in the same direction and everyone knows what to do. And that's very difficult. That's a job that is very difficult, especially at a club like Inter. Inter isn't like Juventus or Liverpool where everyone pulls together. Inter is a club that's very difficult to manage. There's so many different wills and so many different people that want to go in so many different ways. But to get everyone doing that, Mourinho managed to do it, Elenio Herrera managed to do it, Trapattoni managed to do it, Mancini managed to do it in his first term there, and Spalletti's managed to do it so far. So that's we cannot overestimate the importance that Luciano Spalletti has had.
Awesome, Nima. So this was great insight on Sweden. I really appreciate you giving us 2 cents on Inter right now. Everyone definitely check out the awesome articles that Nima is writing for Calcio Mercato's English page. We always recommend the podcast you do on Sempre Inter, Studio Inter, which is really brilliant. So thank you so much for joining us, Nima. I look forward to chatting with you very soon.
Thank you so much for having me, and thanks. Keep up the good work, guys.
Okay, and I've been wanting to have on the podcast for quite some time my friend Matt Lichtenstatter, who's been covering MLS for Gianluca Di Marzio's site for quite some time. He always writes some really insightful articles, and there's one coming tonight. So I wanted to have him on because there's been a lot of taste of Italian football on MLS recently. Like yesterday, I was watching the MLS playoffs, and I have to tell you, for European football snob like me, that isn't very obvious, but I've really gotten into it this season. So I wanted to get Matt's take on the two matches yesterday because they do relate to Italian football a little bit. So Toronto FC is the team, of course, where Giovinco and Bradley play. They qualified yesterday for the final despite a home loss to the New York Red Bulls, and this was quite an exciting game because Josie Altidore, the other key player, was expelled. Something happened in the tunnel. Giovinco got another yellow card, so he missed out. He's going to miss the first leg of the Eastern Conference Final. So with that long-winded intro, I wanted to ask you, Matt, you've been covering MLS for quite some time. Do you consider this Toronto FC team, and let's say at full strength with Altidore and Jovinko, to be the best team you've seen in MLS so far?
It's a pretty good team. You know, they have so much depth, and their top-end players are so good that it's, you know, with MLS, it's all about parity, and any team can beat anybody on every given week. I mean, that happens around the world. Anything can happen on a given day, but more consistently, the good teams are going to beat the bad teams all the time. It's with this Toronto FC team, they are the best team in terms of consistency I've seen in MLS, because everybody can have a really good game at one point. But this TFC team, Jovinko is so good and is unlike any player in MLS, because you just can give him the ball and he can change a game almost instantly. And they have the depth players on top of the designated players, the high-paid players, and that's what sets them apart. And Jovinko's amazing, but you need to have a good defense, you need to have solid goalkeeping, and you're not spending the kind of resources you are on the attackers and the strikers in those positions. And Toronto FC used to never be able to do that. They always had the money, but they never really were able to put the resources effectively to good use. And this year, they've built upon a couple of years of great success, and now this team is so talented that you could argue that they are the best team in regular season MLS history, because they did have the most points. But it's all about winning MLS Cup, and they still have to do that, and they have things to work on before they play the Crew, because the way they played yesterday was not something that will make Greg Vanney very happy.
So do you think they have enough? You mentioned their depth. They're going to be, well, let's see if they can get that Altidore expulsion removed and get him to play. Jovinko almost certainly missed that match because of yellow cards accumulation. Do you think they have enough to at least make it close in the first match?
They have to defend well. The Crew have a great attacking group of players, and we saw that in the first leg against NYCFC. They totally tore them to shreds. And they have the motivation. If your viewers and your listeners haven't heard, there were rumors, and now it's pretty much a certainty, that Anthony Precourt, their owner, is exploring moving the team after next season. So there's a lot of emotion being involved in there, and if anybody's gone through rumors of your team being relocated, that's gut-wrenching. And the Crew responded with that crazy game in Atlanta, which I would, if you can go back and watch it, our first playoff game, that's one of the craziest games I've ever seen in MLS. Great saves, great action, crossbars, penalty shootout was dramatic. And then they were able to win 4-1 over NYCFC. They lost 2-0, but they advanced on the aggregate. They're a really good team. And Toronto, the way it goes in MLS, you don't have to be able to do a ton in a first leg on the road. If Toronto FC get one goal, they're probably going to be in pretty decent shape, as long as they don't get destroyed. And their defending is good enough where I don't think that's going to be a huge issue. But now, the Altidore thing, I don't know if that's going to get overturned. I mean, it happened in the tunnel. None of us saw it unless the MLS Disciplinary Committee changes it, which they can do. They change a lot of things. So we'll see whether they change it. But I think they have enough depth. It's going to be a matter of whether they can hold Columbus in an attacking sense and then try to open up when they get back to Toronto, which they can easily do. So I think they've got a very good chance. But Columbus are not the Red Bulls, and the Red Bulls have always had some playoff issues and really had a lot of attacking problems yesterday, but the Crew I don't think will have those. So we can see. I think Toronto FC are going to be okay. They're clearly, I think, a better team overall. They have fewer defensive issues than the Crew do, but it's going to be a tough game, and the Crew are playing with that determination, that spirit from everything that's going on, which is something you can't quantify.
Excellent. So you mentioned Jovinko a little bit, how he can create something from nothing consistently. You've been following MLS for a long time. Would you say overall he's the best player you've seen in the league so far?
It'd be hard to say no. There are a lot of good players that have come to this league, and there have been a lot of players that have grown in MLS, but Jovinko came at the height of his powers and then just kept on playing incredibly well consistently. His injury issues are kind of unfortunate, but the first couple of years, just watching him play, watching him create, and make other players around him better, it was really amazing to watch, especially early on. I think the league's learned how to defend him a little more, and injuries have caught up to him more in the last couple of seasons, but that free kick against the Red Bulls, it's unstoppable. Yeah. You can't stop that. And I heard some people saying he might be the best dead ball taker in the world right now, which I wouldn't be able to say no to flatly. He just is so talented. He makes players around him so much better, and he links up well with other players in the Toronto SC attack. And the fact that he's been so consistently good, MVP caliber, for three seasons now, and the fact that the Azzurri have not even considered giving him phone calls to come in for important qualifiers, especially the ones that are coming up, is insane. He should be at least considered, because right now, if you're needed somebody to unlock a defense and to play creative soccer and to get you through these times, and Italy right now, I've seen it in some of their attacking games recently, they just haven't been able to create in the way you would think an Italian team can create. Giovinco might be able to do that. What's the risk? I mean, what are you saying? If somebody plays well in MLS, plenty of other national teams have taken players who are playing well in MLS and given them chances. Italy should do the same.
Well, I agree with you there. So let's look at the exact opposite. And look, Andrea Pirlo is probably my favorite player overall from the past 20 years. So you could say that Giovinco is the ideal designated player that an MLS team should do. But unfortunately, Pirlo has really lived up to the stereotype of older European or South American players coming here to retire. I thought yesterday his last match for New York City FC unfortunately really represented his time there. He came in, they still had a chance to score the one goal to make it to the final. He had two chances to set up his team, and it wasn't even close. So do you think MLS clubs are now going to be even more reticent to go for these older players, seeing what Pirlo has done in New York City?
I think Pirlo was maybe the last example of a bit of a dying breed, because teams were already sort of moving away from that model anyway. By the time that NYCFC came into the league, you've seen a lot more young designated players, attacking stars, you know, from South America, some of these younger European players that have come in. And NYCFC kind of moved away from it too when they signed Maxi Morales, who played in Italy for a while, although he's not quite as young. But for Pirlo, I just think that it was harder, considering you watch games at Yankee Stadium. That's not playing games at San Siro or Juventus Stadium. That's playing on a very, very narrow pitch at a baseball stadium. It was hard for him to succeed. He never really hit the ground running. He had injuries. And then he fell out of form when Patrick Vieira came in, and they got better midfielders. And yeah. Pirlo, I think, was already on the decline a bit when he was heading to MLS, and it just never really worked out all that well for him there. And as I said, like, there are going to be some players like Messi and Ronaldo and some of these really bigger names that if they're available to MLS, they will sign them. But I think now, even teams like LAFC, they're signing bigger names, but they're going to sign younger names like a Carlos Vela, somebody who can really capture the imagination of a lot of people, but are younger and aren't, you know, stars past their prime, which used to be the MLS model, and I'll admit that. Now it's about signing younger players. Can they give you something to really build off of now and then potentially sell them on to other clubs? You know, that's, I think, the model that MLS is using now with designated players and transfer fees. And there's more money in the league now to sign better, younger players. And I think that's what MLS clubs are using, and the most successful teams are using it right now. You know, Toronto FC, they're all younger players. Even though they're big names, they're younger. You know, Columbus is signing these kinds of players. Seattle did that a lot, you know, with Lodeiro and other players like that. That's what's for the formula for success right now in Major League Soccer. Not as much the Pirlo model, which was already going out when he was signed. But, yeah, he didn't end his career very well, which is sad, because you would have loved to have seen him do the things he did for so many years in MLS, and it just never was going to work out.
Yeah. So on the opposite side of the spectrum, though, I have to say his teammate, David Villa, every time I've gone down to New York and seen him live, I mean, he really blew me away seeing him in person, even when I watch him on TV. And I know you watch European football, too. Do you think David Villa is still good enough to play? I mean, I'm not saying, you know, for Manchester United, Man City, for, like, say, a mid-table team in a top league. Do you think he's still good enough to lead the line on a team like that?
Maybe less so now than when he went to NYCFC, but he got called in for Spain at, I think he's 35 now, or maybe 36. I don't know his age exactly. I don't have it offhand. But he has been so good. I don't even think NYCFC expected him to be as good as he's been, because I don't think technical ability and sometimes your legs and your athleticism go, but instincts don't. You sometimes become more instinctual as a player when you get older. And that's what Villa has been. You know, he's not the David Villa, the swashbuckling David Villa of his Barcelona days, but he still has those instincts, that predatory aspect to his game where he could score goals, and a lot of MLS defenders aren't going to be able to cope with that, you know, and that's been something that's been so impressive with Villa, and the fact that he's done it in three consecutive seasons is incredibly impressive too, and I think he could go back to Europe if he wanted to. I don't think he wants to now. I think he likes life in New York City. I think he likes life in Major League Soccer. I know there was some interest. I saw reports at one point recently. There were interests from clubs in Europe to sign him because everybody wants goal scoring, and it doesn't really matter where it comes. If it's David Villa, it's David Villa. And they found a bit of a gem with Villa, and I don't think anybody expected it to work out the way it has worked out. He's got off the top of my head, I think it's like 60-plus goals in the last 3 years. And it's so impressive what he's been able to do. Other clubs might want him. I think that window's probably shut now because he's older. But his three seasons in MLS have proven that if you do your due diligence and you can make the right signings, any player can work out in this league. And Villa's certainly done that.
Very interesting. So the last thing I wanted to ask you about is Atlanta United FC has been really a huge success. You know, we've seen them get over 70,000 fans in their stadium multiple times. I was down in Atlanta in April, May. I was shocked to see how much buzz there is in the city for the team. So tell me a little bit why you think it has really worked there. And I also wanted to ask you about one of their young players. You mentioned MLS teams going for younger designated players, Miguel Almiron, who's already generating quite a bit of interest in Europe. So maybe start with him. Tell us how good you think he is and tell us why you think Atlanta has been such a huge success in MLS.
Yeah, well, we'll start with Almiron. Tata Martino's a great coach, and that's the kind of player that fits perfectly. But Almiron's really the continuation of a trend in Major League Soccer of signing these young South American attacking players. Diego Valeri started it, and then you now have Ignacio Piatti and players like Federico Higuain. Gonzalo Higuain's older brother has been in Major League Soccer for a very long time and has been very successful with the Crew. And now every team basically has one at this point now. And Almiron is, you could argue, the most flashy, the most technically gifted, and at the height of his powers, because he's only, I think, 22 or 23. So he's still very young. And Atlanta spent a lot of money to sign him, but they signed him on the edge of a growth curve. That means he's still rising. With some of these other players, they signed them at the height of their powers or as they were declining a little bit. That's not the case with Almiron, and he's been so good. His instincts are so great, and with this counterattacking, this pressing style, he fits so perfectly, and the way he's able to unlock defenses, working in that attack with Villalba and Assad and Joseph Martinez, who have all been just so good, it's all worked so well for Atlanta. And Almiron, I'm not surprised that he's drawing European interest. Atlanta will have a tough time keeping up, but they can basically name their price. They don't have to sell. They have all the money that they'll ever need to either A, replace him, or B, pay him more if they want to. And again, in talking about national teams, Paraguay has still called him in consistently. So going to MLS doesn't necessarily affect your chances of being called in by an international manager. And as for Atlanta United, there are a lot of reasons why this is successful. I've got family in the area, so I've been to an Atlanta United game, not at the new stadium, but at Bobby Dodd Stadium, where Georgia Tech plays football. It's a crazy atmosphere. A lot of it, I think, is Atlanta's a very transient city. Lots of people from lots of different places go there. And all of their older sports teams were created there and came there in the 60s. And when you go to Atlanta, as more people have done, you take your old allegiances with you. If you're coming from Boston, you're not changing your allegiances to Atlanta teams or New York or Chicago or anywhere else. You're going to keep those when you go there. But the soccer, nobody has any connections to soccer in Atlanta already. So when the team came here, somebody joked that it's like Atlanta's first true professional sports team because everybody can attach onto it. And then you have a very good immigrant community, good Latin American community. I remember hearing a story about some, I think it's Brazilians, going to games and were like, we now have a team to root for here. And everybody has caught on to it. It's a place where there's a lot of grassroots soccer that is played. And so it just caught on instantly. I think a lot of people thought it would be successful, but nobody thought it would be this successful. That's the combination of the money that's been spent by Arthur Blank, who owns the Falcons. It's the combination of just a fervent atmosphere, I think, in the right place at the right time. And I don't think this success is replicable. There aren't many cities that have the same sort of dynamics that Atlanta does. But when you look at this city and you look at how successful they are, this is why MLS expansion in some ways has to happen, because there are so many untapped markets that could really support like this. Now, they're not going to be Atlanta. I don't think there's anybody who could replicate what Atlanta is doing in that way. But right now what they have is a team that's playing a really good brand of soccer, capitalizing on a market that was really untapped, and a combination of circumstances that led this to being a truly, like, maybe you could argue the second most popular team in the market. And that's a place, if you're getting 67,000 people to watch a playoff game on short notice on a Thursday night during the college football season in the South, that's a really impressive thing that they've done. And we can't lose sight of how impressive this is. And it's a reason why I say when the season starts next year and the big games are going to be played in Atlanta, you need to watch them, not just because of the way the team is playing, but you're not going to see a better crowd on most Saturdays anywhere across the world than you're going to see at Mercedes-Benz Stadium. Even when it's at 45,000, the atmosphere is pretty nuts. But at 70,000, you can't believe you're watching soccer in the United States. And remember, MLS is 20 years old. You know, this league has gone so far in such a short amount of time. They have made mistakes. They have made missteps. But when you see steps like this, you're just wondering, there is so much more for the sport to grow and the league to grow in this country if more Atlanta-type successes can be found. But that's going to be difficult, and it's going to take a lot of due diligence to get them.
Awesome. Well, Matt, thank you so much for your insight. We're going to post one of your articles tonight. Everyone, follow Matt at Matt's Musings 1. Really great work. You did a fantastic job in your debut on Culture Land, so thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Looking forward to coming
back. Awesome.